This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
And this is the second Saturday, so it's the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. Welcome to the 10th Voice here at KKFI. And we are going to be discussing today the wonderful nonfiction history of LGBT movements, and it's The Gay Revolution by Lillian Faderman. Lillian, are you on the line?
I'm here. Yes, hi.
Hello. And Lynn?
Right here.
Cheryl?
I'm here, Elizabeth.
Okay. I would like to start with just a little bit of general background, if that's all right. I want to ask each of you why you're passionate about LGBT history and why you feel it is vital, especially today. And I'm going to start with Cheryl, since you're involved in the Legacies of Lesbian Literature Project.
Hi, Elizabeth. I became involved, really heavily involved, when I lost my spouse, Sandra Moran, who this radio book club is named after. She was involved with Marianne K. Martin, and they were just beginning to work on a documentary of the history of lesbian literature, fiction. So when we lost Sandra, Marianne asked me if I would help out on that project, and I said, gosh, you know, I'm a nonfiction reader. Well, I don't read a lot of fiction. And Marianne said, but we need project management help. And so I said, if that's what you need, sign me up. And so I've been involved with that since then. We have a wonderful documentary filmmaker by the name of Lisa Marie Evans, who's working with us and has, in fact, interviewed Lillian for our documentary. So that's why I'm especially interested in the history.
Thank you so much. Lynn, I know that you specialized in American history. Why is LGBT history important to you?
Well, for so many reasons. First of all, I'm so grateful to be here and to be able to talk to you and talk to Lillian about this fabulous book. It's just remarkable. You know, the history is, of course, interwoven in my life, as it has been. You know, I had a life prior to becoming an author. I was in the media at first. I was a broadcast journalist where I couldn't be out. And then I was in New York State politics. I was press secretary of the Senate minority leader in the 80s when ACT UP was very active. And I had to step over friends who were protesting in front of the governor's office. And, you know, it's just been part and parcel of my life and my history throughout all time. And beyond that, yes, I was an American history major in college. And the one thing that we never talked about, the one thing we never even began to explore, was the love that dare not speak its name. We never even entertained what was happening or what had happened earlier in the 20th century and before that. And it just seems to me that it's such a major omission in our education. And that needed to be rectified. And boy, Lillian has certainly done that for all of us in spades. And I'm so grateful for that.
Well, this would be the perfect opportunity to ask you, Lillian. You have spent your career in this field, and clearly you are still passionate about the research and the writing. Could you please tell why you made this your life's work?
Yes, I came at it from a very personal perspective. I realized I was a lesbian as a teenager. In 1956, I got a phony ID, and a gay boy friend introduced me to the lesbian bar culture in the 1950s. And it really seemed to me that we had no history, that it was all today, this, what I saw in the 1950s. We weren't dignified with a history. I was a literary kid, and so as soon as I realized I was a lesbian, I went to the library and I looked up homosexuality, and what I found is books of abnormal psychology, and that was about it. And then I found the pulp novels, and that was wonderful, but invariably we ended up dying in those novels, either committing suicide or drowning in a well of loneliness or, you know, whatever, something tragic. So we simply were not dignified with our history. And then I became a college student, and I wanted very much to find out a bit about lesbian and gay history. We were all called gay in those days, incidentally, whether we were lesbian or gay or transgender. Gay was the umbrella term for all of us. And the only time I heard about our history was in abnormal psych classes, or one abnormal psych class that I took. And then I became a graduate student. This was in the 1960s, and I thought, wow, it would be so wonderful if I could write about gay or lesbian history. But that was, as was already said, the love that dare not speak its name, and so of course I didn't dare to write about anything like that. But I got my PhD in 1967, and the women's movement was just beginning to really get steam by then. And very soon after that, in 1969, there were the Stonewall riots, and then the rise of the lesbian feminist movement in 1970. And I began to realize that maybe I could write about that sort of thing. And so beginning in 1975, I published my first articles on lesbian history at that time. And then in 1981, my book Surpassing the Love of Men came out, and I sort of never stopped since then. That became my life's work, because finally I realized that I could talk about it, I could write about it, and I could create what virtually had not been before. That is a record of our gay and lesbian histories.
I'll just mention that the Santa Moran Radio Book Club, we have done some other books documenting our history, Julia Allen's Passionate Commitments, and Cheryl and Lynn, you both discussed that book on the panel, and Mark Siegel's And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality, and Bonnie Morris's The Disappearing L. And I'm particularly interested in the fact that this is Women's History Month. So in this book, I found that lesbians tended to be caught between two different groups, gay men who often headed organizations, and women, for instance, in NOW, who really were a little uncomfortable with lesbians. What I want to ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Lynn, is what women in this book should people know about?
You know, there are so many women in this book that feature so prominently. We can start on the side of those who were not interested in lesbians or were actively opposed to the appearance of lesbians or even the mention of them. We can talk about Anita Bryant, and we can talk about Betty Friedan. But if we want to talk about women who made a difference for us, let's talk about, you know, all of those women at the beginning of the movie who stuck their necks out in order to make it possible. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon and the Daughters of Bilitis. And, you know, we can go back, we can talk about Rita Mae Brown and the radicals of the 70s who were so adamant about doing actions in order to bring attention to us. We can go back further and talk about Jean Cordova. And there were so many powerful women who just weren't going to take no for an answer. And I am so indebted, we all are so indebted to what they did at the outset to, you know, make their voices heard. Barbara Giddings, who is such a major figure at the beginning and with Frank Kimony did so much good work. You know, there's just so many women of note. I find it so interesting as I look at all of this, and I know we'll probably get to some of this later, but as I look at the history at the beginning of, you know, the 50s and the 40s and all of that, and I look at where we are now, I see so many changes. And yet at the same time, you know, history is coming back around wearing just a little different face. And I think that the parallels are most interesting. But in terms of the women, Carla Jay, there are so many. Robin Tyler, I could go on forever, but I'll let you go on to somebody else.
Certainly, for me, when I came out, Margareta Kammermeyer, her book was so important, and I gave it to my mother to read because my mother kind of got it. I came out late in life. I want to ask you, Lillian, you did interview Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, didn't you?
I interviewed them for my book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, and I also quote them in The Gay Revolution. So, yeah, and if I were asked where our movement began, I would certainly say with Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. And I think their biggest contribution was, well, number one, to just have an organization like the Daughters of Bilitis in 1955. That was remarkable. That was the height of the McCarthy era. It was the height of witch hunting. It was the height of persecution against gays and lesbians, so that they could be brave enough to start that organization together with some other women and then keep it going. And perhaps even more important was the latter, the magazine that came out of the organization, because it never had huge circulation, but it had national circulation. And so people in tiny towns all over America, and even outside of America, I interviewed Robin Tyler, who told me that in Manitoba, in Canada, as a young person, she ran across a copy of the latter in a bookstore, and she realized there were more people like her, and it changed her life. So the latter, that magazine with not a particularly huge circulation, but nevertheless it got around, and I think it really changed many women's lives. And then I think if I had to mention someone else who was especially important in the lesbian movement in those days, was Barbara Giddings, who took over the latter in 1963 and made it an entirely different kind of magazine, made it a very bold political magazine. She was perhaps the first one that insisted that lesbians and gays needed to take their grievances public. And she worked with Frank Kameny and was very much inspired by him. And she, I think, was really a pivotal figure. I think if I had to name one person as the mother of the LGBTQ, as we call it now, movement, I would say it was Barbara Giddings, who was very militant, much more so perhaps than Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, although their contribution was terrific because they conceived of the organization and they kept it going, the Daughters of Bilitis and the magazine, the latter.
And one of the things that struck me, and I'll ask you, Cheryl, if this is true for you too, was throughout the decades, progress was so uneven. It was a step forward, two steps back, or two steps forward and a step back. Is that what you noticed as well?
Yes, it absolutely was. And I thought your previous discussion where you talked about the fact that the lesbians and the gays didn't really work together much. They kept trying to, and then, you know, they'd split apart again. And so to me, that is one of the big takeaways from your book, Lillian, for me, was that the lack of coordination, I guess, between those two groups and how I felt like it did kind of push things forward and then slow things back. And to your point, Elizabeth, you know, it pushed forward and back.
Lillian, do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, I think it's true that there have been periods where there were huge splits among lesbians and gays, particularly in the 1970s, when I think most lesbians who were politically active really understood that they were women and they aligned themselves with the women's movement much more than with the gay movement. It happened even with the radical organizations in the 1970s. For instance, in the Gay Liberation Front, which was the first radical gay organization to come out of the Stonewall riots, the Gay Liberation Front formed soon after the riots, and it included a number of radical lesbians, and they soon realized that as women, their causes were being neglected. And so Rita Mae Brown actually played the Pied Piper with them. She went to a meeting of the Gay Liberation Front in 1970, and she got up and she said to the lesbians present, you're women, you're not the same as these gay men, and we need to form our own organization. And with Rita Mae Brown, a lot of the women in the Gay Liberation Front formed an organization called the Radical Lesbians. The same thing happened in another fairly radical gay organization that was formed in the early 1970s, and that was the Gay Activist Alliance. And here, a wonderful woman by the name of Jean O'Leary played the Pied Piper and said to the group, not all gay concerns are women's concerns. We're not so concerned about entrapment in public restrooms, for instance. We need to break off and form our own committee. And they did. They formed a Women's Liberation Committee. And I think this was true through much of the 70s when lesbians felt that they didn't have a lot in common with gay men. And it, in some ways, it was really quite wonderful, and in other ways, it was unfortunate. The wonderful parts were that they managed to create a lesbian feminist culture, which was unprecedented and fabulous. They had women's music festivals, for instance, and women's bookstores and women's publishing houses and women's communes, and they put together so much that was culturally unique. It was unfortunate because they sort of dropped out of the gay movement, and it meant that there wasn't a unified front between lesbians and gay men in the 1970s. That changed, I think, beginning with the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, because I think a lot of lesbians, even those who had been lesbian feminists, realized that in the face of such death, in the face of such governmental unfairness, where the government refused to put money into research for a cure for AIDS, lesbians had to step up to the plate, and they did. I'm working now on an LGBTQ exhibit for a San Diego museum, and I was so impressed to see in San Diego, as elsewhere, all over the country, lesbians were really in the forefront of leadership to help gay men get through those plague years. And so in San Diego, for instance, they formed a group called Blood Sisters that was formed just so that lesbians could donate blood for gay men who needed transfusions, because even gay men who were healthy were not allowed to donate blood. They formed Mama's Kitchen, which was responsible for preparing and serving, delivering meals to gay men with AIDS or who were HIV positive and just didn't have the strength or wherewithal to cook for themselves anymore. So it was so interesting to me as I did my research and as I continue to hear these stories in San Diego in my present project, how active lesbians were in helping gay men through the terrible AIDS crisis. It also meant that because so many gay men who had had leadership roles before were so sick, lesbians jumped into those leadership roles. I discovered, again, in my research for the exhibit that we're going to have, that lesbians became the heads of huge concerns in San Diego. They began to head the gay center. It was also true in Los Angeles. Lesbians headed the gay center and took over all sorts of national organizations and showed women had the wherewithal and the brain power and the capacity to organize, as they weren't given a chance to do in the 1970s. And that all began to happen in the 1980s.
Lillian, would you also say that, in my experience, part of that coming together of the gay and lesbian cultures was also that lesbians at the time were among the only people who weren't afraid that they would somehow contract AIDS just by being present with gay men? So much fear about how you could contract this disease, and there was so much misinformation and lack of information that, in my personal experience, you know, a lot of it was that lesbians would step in and take care of these guys when other people treated them as pariahs and wouldn't go anywhere near them.
Exactly. I think you're exactly right about that, that lesbians understood that you don't get AIDS from a handshake, or you don't get AIDS by serving a meal to someone who has AIDS, because there was just such fear in the country. It was like the fear of the bubonic plague, and it was based on such ignorance. People didn't know for a long time how AIDS was actually contracted, but lesbians understood that you don't get it by casual contact with another human being. And so I think they were able to, they navigated the medical system for gay men with AIDS. In the 1950s and 60s and throughout the 70s, if a woman had a profession before women were permitted into professional life, such as the law or even becoming a doctor, women with professions tended to be teachers, social workers or nurses. And so here were all of these lesbians who were social workers and they were nurses, and they knew how to navigate the medical system for gay men. And so they were able to help gay men with AIDS through that system. So, yeah, I think that, of course, AIDS was the worst disaster, health disaster that I think had ever happened in America, and it was a terrible tragedy. But I think it was also, in some ways, the beginning of healing between lesbians and gay men, healing after a huge split in the 1970s.
You had mentioned this, Elizabeth, in the book, that there had been radical movements early on during Stonewall, the street transvestite action revolutionary star. And it's particularly during the AIDS crisis, funding wasn't being put into it. And you pointed out that it was also the radicals who pushed things along and made changes through ZAPS and ACT UP and so on. Cheryl, any reactions?
Yeah, one of the things I paid attention to, Lillian, when you were talking about the AIDS in that whole time frame, was that kind of got us going again, I guess you'd say, kind of renewed our fight for civil rights after that. We learned how to work together to go after AIDS, and that kind of positioned us then to really go after and renew the fight for civil rights after that.
I think that's such a good observation. Absolutely. Yeah, I think what we realized in the midst of the tragedy of the AIDS epidemic was that we could work together. We could demand not only that the federal government put more money into research for a cure, but we could also demand our rights by working together as a unified movement. And it made a huge difference in the progress of subsequent decades. But I think that the question was raised is a very good one about radicals in the movement. And I think it was ever thus. I think it's probably true in most movements that bring about revolutionary change. So what happened in what we now call the LGBTQ movement, what we used to call the gay movement as an umbrella term, what happened is that, of course, there was a movement before, the homophile movement, that was wonderful simply by virtue of the fact that it existed in such homophobic times. And so there was Daughters of Bilitis, there was the Mattachine Society. And then at the very end of the 60s, in 1969, there was the Stonewall Riots, led by young radical gay people who had seen all of the radical movements of the 1960s. The black movement and the Latino movement and American Indian movement, all of these movements for rights that were radical. And these young radical kids realized that that's what we needed in a gay movement. And so they formed groups such as the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Alliance. And they made some progress, and they got the word gay out there, the love that dare not speak its name. They managed to get that word out there in the media. And I think they made things a little safer for more what we can call mainstream gays and lesbians. And so organizations began to form, like the National Gay Task Force, which, when it started in the 1970s, was a very mainstream kind of organization with a board of directors made up of doctors and lawyers, gay doctors and lawyers. And they were able to approach the media, for instance, to complain about the terrible images of gays and lesbians in the media. Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund formed about the same time in 1973, and they were able to approach the courts to complain about the lack of rights that gays and lesbians had in the courts of the United States. So my point is that the movement started on a radical footing in 1969 with the Stonewall Riots, but radicals made the world a little safer for more mainstream lesbians and gays, and so these mainstream organizations began to form as a result of the radical movement, began to form and began to approach American institutions, the media, the courts, to say that things had to change. But without the radicals, I don't think that would have happened.
Elizabeth, I could follow up on that. Lillian, that's the point that I was getting to earlier when I said, you know, there was so much tension between those who urged radical action than those who wanted to take a more mainstream approach like Frank Kameny. It seems to me, and these are arguments that continue to this day, about which is more efficient and effective, which gets better action, and do we want to be mainstreamed or do we want to be separate? Should we want to be mainstreamed? You know, it seems to me that those tensions, those movements cannot and would not have created as much change without each other. In other words,
I think you're exactly right. And, you know, it was sort of like, as far as the straight world is concerned, it was sort of like good cop, bad cop. You know, I think mainstreamers were able to go in and say the laws have to be changed, and if you don't change the laws, you're going to get these other cops after you, the, quote, bad cops, the radicals. So you better change the laws now, or you better change the presentation of gay people in the media, or you're going to get these constant zaps. So I think that the two work together. I think radicals and mainstreamers work together. And it doesn't mean that they were always happy with each other. And I think that's still the case. You know, I think radicals think that, why did we waste all of this energy getting same-sex marriage equality? Or why did we waste all of this energy getting the right to serve in the military? I think they would say they don't want to be married. They don't want to serve in the military. This was a mainstream issue. So there are still conflicts between radicals and mainstreamers. Factions existed. Not that they love each other, not that they ever loved each other, but I think it was important that they were both out there, both making their arguments.
Now we're going to play some of a song called Change Is Gonna Come by Kaya Hartwood. Please, both all of you, hang on. We're going to come back.
I said change.
And we were talking about Change Is Gonna Come, and we are discussing Lillian Faderman's The Gay Revolution and how change is brought about. And one of the themes, Lillian refers to the streets versus the suits, or sometimes I think of them as the A-gays. And Lynn, you had a question.
Lillian, I'm curious, part of that streets versus suits mentality spawned something in the 80s and early 90s. I don't see it mentioned in the book, but I'm curious, I'm sure you thought about it, and that is we were throwing ourselves out of the closet, as in other people within the movement, those who were more radical, were deciding that we all needed to come out, and they were threatening to out us if we did not out ourselves. It was their opinion that that was the only way to get action, was to be that visible. I had a personal encounter of that kind when I was in New York State government with a name you'll recognize, that was Ginny Appuzo, who tried to throw me out of who threatened to throw me out of the closet, demanded a meeting with me. If I would not out myself, she would do it for me. And my argument to her was, I was perfectly happy to get out of the closet, but my partner at the time was not. And we went nose to nose, toe to toe about it, and I got her to back down in the end because I could try to explain to her that I really felt that there was more I could do within government from my position, from the vantage point I was in, than I could have done otherwise. But there was a whole period of time where there was a serious discussion within our community about throwing people who were in positions of power or in positions of influence out of the closet.
It's always seemed to me that people have to come out at their own pace, and everyone's circumstances are different. And I've always been opposed to outing unless it's a public figure who has done us wrong. And then I think outing is appropriate. And there have been all sorts of cases like that. But having said that, let me also say that I think that we've made the kind of progress that we've made in the last decades because more and more of us have come out. And the more people who come out, the safer it feels for other people to come out. You know, it used to be when I first became a lesbian or recognized myself as a lesbian in the 1950s that straight people thought they knew no homosexuals, which was their major word for people like us that we would now call LGBTQ, etc. Straight people thought that homosexuals are these guys that hide in the shadows ready to pounce on some 14-year-old kid. But as more of us have come out, the straight world has come to understand that gay people or LGBTQ people are we're your sisters, we're your brothers, we're your sons and daughters, we're the neighbor that you like so much or the coworker that you've had such good relationships with. As that happens, prejudices disappear, and I think that's why in the 1990s, soon after the Defense of Marriage Act was passed, there was a Gallup poll that asked Americans how many of them had a close friend or a relative who was lesbian or gay. Only 22% of America said that, yes, they had a close friend or a lesbian who was a close friend or a relative who was lesbian or gay. And that was already in the 1990s. In more recent polls, Gallup polls that were taken just a few years ago, when people were asked if they had a close friend or a relative who was lesbian or gay, or they knew of someone who was lesbian or gay, 75% of Americans replied yes to that question. And I think that's what's made such a huge difference from 22% in the 1990s to 75% in more recent times. America has to know that we're everywhere, that we are in your family, that we are people that you love. And America has come to understand that, and I think that's why we've made the kind of progress that we've made in recent years. So coming out is very important, but forcing people out of the closet, unless they're our enemy and they're public figures, forcing people out of the closet is a whole other issue, and I think that's very sad when that happens.
Of course, Harvey Milk, as you mentioned, exhorting people to come out wherever you are.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I've just done a biography of Harvey Milk, which is going to be published on his birthday on May 22nd. And, yeah, I think that's one of Harvey Milk's biggest contributions. He's yelling, come out, wherever you are. He was assassinated, as you know, in 1978. So he was making that point in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s. And I think he was exactly right, that would make all the difference and has made all the difference in our progress.
Lillian, this is Cheryl. I completely agree with you that I think society has opened their arms more to us because we're faces now. We're faces to our family and to friends. And, you know, they know us as individuals, and they, you know, they love us for who we are as individuals, and they see beyond that. So we're not gay first and then Cheryl. You know, it's Cheryl,
yes.
And then also Cheryl is a lesbian.
Yes. Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's so much harder to hate gay people or LGBTQ people, as we say now, so much harder to hate us if you realize that we're your sisters and brothers and next-door neighbors. And it makes all the difference, has made all the difference.
If you don't mind, let's talk about some of those people who stepped forward and outed themselves and made a difference, the unlikely heroes all the way through this book. As an example, one that struck me was Midge Costanza was asked by Jimmy Carter to come into the White House. She invited LGBT groups in. It was really the first meeting in the White House, and she ended up leaving not long after. I found that a fascinating anecdote,
yes,
Lillian.
That was really remarkable. I think Midge Costanza was closeted in 1977 when she invited a dozen lesbian and gay people for a meeting in the White House, and Jimmy Carter wasn't present at that meeting. He was at Camp David at that time. So who knows whether he really knew what Midge Costanza was going to do. But it was a remarkable meeting with lesbian and gay leaders from all over the country. And I don't think that a great deal was accomplished in practical terms as a result of the meeting. There were no huge reforms as a result of the meeting. But what was so important because of that 1977 meeting is that gay people and lesbians all over the country knew of the existence of that meeting and really took heart from it. I don't think they realized that Jimmy Carter wasn't even in the White House then, but the fact that gays and lesbians who were so cut out of the White House or politics or any sort of public face, the fact that they should be able to go through those doors of the White House. And Frank Kameny had protested in front of the White House in 1965. Midge Costanza invited him to that meeting, and the first thing she said when the group came through the doors of the White House, she greeted Kameny first, and she said, "This is long overdue. Welcome to the White House, which is your house. That is, it's the house of all Americans." And that was so important, and it got reported in the gay press, and I think it was so heartening for all of us that should have happened. So, yes, she was an unlikely hero. She was demoted because of it. She had a big staff in a room close to an office close to President Carter's office, and she was demoted to some basement room, and her staff was cut, and finally she just quit her job at the White House and then came out afterwards. But while she was in the White House, she was not out. Nevertheless, it was a fabulous, very important meeting.
Cheryl, let me ask you, were there any figures in the book that you considered unlikely heroes?
Well, I think we've talked about it earlier. I'm Kamelmeyer. You know, I really felt some sadness for her. You know, she was just being honest at a time when she thought being honest was the thing to do. But she certainly made a difference for us through the experience that happened to her there.
I certainly agree. Yes. Lynn?
There were so many unlikely heroes, people who were just living their lives. And the ordinariness of their extraordinariness, I think, is what I would say, or the extraordinariness of their ordinariness, more likely, because all they were trying to do was to do something decent. In fact, I met one of those people recently, and you only mentioned him towards the end of the book because he comes towards the end of our history, Lillian, and that is Jim Obergefell. What a nice man. And, you know, when I had a conversation with him, what he said to me was, "Look, all I wanted to do was to do this little thing." And it turned into something that he never anticipated. He viewed himself as an unlikely hero in, you know, the movement to marry. But he's grateful to accept the mantle just because it makes such a difference for all of us.
Yes, exactly. And for listeners who don't know of Jim Obergefell, the Supreme Court case of 2015 is named after him, the case in which the Supreme Court declared that to deny gays and lesbians marriage equality was unconstitutional. And his story is just a very moving one, and of course a very important case to have come before the Supreme Court. His partner was fatally ill. They lived in a state that was not a state in which same-sex couples could get married. They had to charter a private plane because his partner was so ill. The plane sat on the tarmac while they were married on the grounds of a state that permitted same-sex marriage. They went back to Ohio. His partner died. And then Ohio would not permit any indication that Jim Obergefell was married to the partner who died. He was not permitted anything that spouses are permitted in terms of state recognition of the surviving partner, surviving spouse. And he fought that case all the way to the Supreme Court. I don't think Jim saw himself as a hero, but he was very brave to fight it, and he helped to win us the right to marry all over the United States.
This is Cheryl, just to swing around on someone else, Frank Kameny, you know, I just wonder, where would we be had he won his appeal?
And you know? I think that's an excellent person to bring up. Frank Kameny was a PhD astronomer working for the Army Map Service in a civilian position, and in 1957 it was discovered that he was a homosexual. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. Despite the fact that they had loved him in the Army Map Service, he was fired from his job. He tried to appeal the firing all the way to the Supreme Court without success. The Supreme Court would not take his case. And so in 1961, he founded Mattachine Society Washington in D.C. And in 1965, he was the first one to dare to do this. He led a series of public pickets in front of the White House, in front of the Pentagon, and then in Philadelphia at Independence Hall. And he got other gays and lesbians to agree to come out and to picket with him. There were never huge numbers of picketers. Nevertheless, just the bravery of that, the bravery of being able to stand up and be seen in public as an out homosexual, as most people were called in front of the public in those days, it was just incredible. And the foresight that he had, he helped people challenge their firing in the courts in D.C., and he won for them many cases. He was their legal advisor. And in the 1960s, a number of cases were won against the Civil Service Commission in the 1960s. And so he was so prescient and so brave in what he did. And I think the way this question was framed was excellent. If he had won his case in 1957, he wouldn't have had any gripes, and he wouldn't have become the hero that he became in our history.
I was fascinated by the few pages that you devoted to Kylar Broadus. He had been harassed on the job in Missouri, and he had been asked questions about his sex life. He was basically drummed out of his job, and he went before the U.S. Senate, the first time a transgender man had appeared, or a transgender person had appeared before the Senate, and said, "I am a transgender man."
That was very brave. And of course, if he hadn't been so harassed and so persecuted in Missouri, he would never have appeared before the U.S. Senate and made the Senate understand. And I think before Broadus's appearance, the U.S. Senate had probably never seen a trans person, and he put a human face on what it was to be trans and on the persecution that trans people suffered. And so a very important case. There was also the case of a trans woman who went before a congressional committee, a House committee, Vandy Beth Campbell, and put a human face on what it was like to be a trans woman. And I think in her case, too, she really made a huge change in the thinking of Congress people who were on that House committee. And so, yes, I think in some ways persecution has really ignited the will to fight and the will to make changes. And so those are certainly unlikely heroes who wouldn't have been heroes if they hadn't been persecuted.
If it's all right with you three, I'd like to talk about the impeccable, prodigious amount of research in this
Please
book.
Please do. Yeah.
Yeah. Lillian, my first question is, do you live in archives?
Yes, actually, I do. Right. The research that I'm doing now, as I had mentioned earlier, is for a museum exhibit. It's the San Diego History Center. It's one of the first times that a mainstream American museum is doing an LGBTQ exhibit, and I'm very excited that they're doing it. And so presently, yes, I'm living in the Lambda Archives here in San Diego, and it's a 15-hour-a-day job. It's very exciting to me. It's what I love to do, and I think it's my kind of activism. I think as a writer, just the idea of bringing to light stories that have been so neglected, it's just really been important to me, and it's been my life's work with great, great pleasure.
How long did it take you to research this book?
It was about a 5-year project. I started about 5 years before the book came out, which was in 2016. 15, and I did a lot of the research and then organized my notes and started writing, and then I realized I needed to do a lot more research. So altogether, it was about 5 years.
And Cheryl, do you have a comment or a question on the research?
Well, what I want to say to the audience listening in to this show is, please do not let the size of this book keep you from reading it, because it is so well done. Lillian, it is great storytelling, too. One of my favorite authors is Doris Kearns Goodwin, and the reason I love her work is because she makes history exciting, and you have done that very same thing with this book, and it is a page-turner, truly.
One of the things I found myself doing, it slowed my reading down, but in a very wonderful way. I kept looking up people and groups and events, and I would go down the rabbit hole. It is completely readable, and I learned so much. So thank you, Lillian.
Thank you, and thank you for all inviting me to be part of this, and thank you for your participation.
I have one last question, and it's for each of you, and I'll start with you, Lynn. After this book and where we are today politically in this country, are you encouraged or discouraged? Because after all, we're seeing hate crimes, religious freedom lawsuits, anti-LGBT bills. But after having read this book, where are you?
You know, I'm actually encouraged, because I think that it's often said, and I'm sure, Lillian, I hope you would agree with this, that we cannot understand where we are or where we're going until we know where we've been.
Absolutely.
And in this case,
yes.
You know, with work like this, if we are paying attention, we can learn the lessons from the past. And I think I'm encouraged that we have the fortitude to do that. But I will also say that I am cautious. I'm cautious about the current generation that is not paying enough attention to where we've been and thinks that the things that we have now have always been. In fact, I had this conversation, Cheryl and I both did, just the other day. Someone was sitting in our living room from Middlebury College, which is where I went to school, and I gave them the book, Lillian, and I said, if you are not teaching this in your curriculum, you need to be teaching this, and every college and university in the country should be teaching this book.
Cheryl, you agree, I take it, that you are encouraged overall?
I am encouraged, and I also remember from the book, Lillian, you made a comment around the Anita Bryant story. I think it was Eric Hoffer that said, a mass movement can get along just fine without a God, but it won't get very far without a devil. That's not the exact quote, but
right.
You know, it things like this, it puts a fire under us, and we make things happen.
Yeah, I think you're both exactly right. I think that we're going through a little bad patch now. I think that all sorts of scary things have been happening within the last year or so. But we have to learn from history that we've gone through bad patches before, and we know how to unite and fight. And I have confidence that we're going to do it again. I don't think we're going to be set back for long, because we know how to organize. We know how to protest. And I love what George Santayana said. If you don't learn from history, you're destined to repeat it. So I think young people have to learn our history, have to learn how we went through this terrible period and learned how to work together, learned how to demand our rights, and things got better for us. And now there have been a few setbacks, but we're going to fight them, I think. I have great optimism for the future.
Thank you all very much. We're just about out of time, so let me have some contact information for each of you. Lillian, where could one find information? And thank you.
I have a webpage. It's lillianfaderman.net, and that's probably the best way to reach me, and my email is on the webpage as well. And I want to thank you so much for inviting me to be on this panel. This was great.
It's been a pleasure. And Lynn, you have a new novel coming out.
My new novel, Great Bones, will be out in just a couple of weeks.